Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and happy holidays to you. Larry Mueller here. Going to take a look at the biggest weather events of 2011, talk a little about 2012, and certainly answer your weather and climate questions today as we visit with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's also a professor in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. So great to have them with us. And if you have some questions for them, I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you have a question and maybe a photo to share, I hope you'll go to my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post your photos or questions or comments there. We'd love to hear from you for sure. Steve, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's great being here.
Yeah, John Martin, thank you for coming by.
You bet, Larry. Good to see you.
Well, we've got lots of things we can talk about. The weather, I mean, if you look outside today, I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to complain.
Yeah. Day here in southern Wisconsin.
It is.
I mean, it's warm.
No wind. No clouds.
Oh, it's windy out there now, at least by my house.
Yeah,
yeah, my house, the
wind
picked up.
Oh,
yeah.
Is that right? You're right near the lake, though.
That could be the lake coming up there.
Yeah.
Well, but it was beautiful at mine today with no wind. That's the thing. When it's 30 degrees and sunny, you know, you look at the thermometer and say, oh, I better put a jacket on. But when it's not windy, you don't need to.
Yeah. Well, it's and no
I'm sure people in Florida aren't saying that.
Yeah, right. Probably not.
And not a whole lot of snow, at least in southern Wisconsin. Northern Wisconsin's got some snow.
They got some snow, but not very much.
Right. That's right. They keep getting kind of nicked by these storms that are going across southern Canada, and they get a little bit out of them. We get almost nothing. I mean, has it snowed on 5 days this year? That's it?
I think it's been five calendar days. Yeah.
And
we've small had amounts.
Measurable snow once.
Once, right.
Or twice in those 5 days. Less than an inch. Unbelievable.
Well, I'll tell you, we had a Facebook question from, who says, he has a great question for you. Why does it seem that for the past few years, states south of us, okay, Kansas, have been getting more snow than Wisconsin has been getting?
I think it just seems that
way.
I think the
key word is seems. All you have to do is go back to, 2008, 2009?
2007, 2008.
Oh, 2007, 2008, which is within the five-year range quoted by the question, where we had 103 inches of snow for our seasonal total and blowing our old record away by, on the order of 25 inches or something.
Yeah,
it was a 25% increase over the historical record, which itself was way above the next highest finisher. So I'm not sure about that. I mean, so far this year, for sure, we've got a weird situation going on. I don't know what's happened in Kansas. They had a recent storm in the southern plain states maybe a week ago. I don't know if it got all the way to southwest Kansas, but it's certainly an unusual December for us this year, but really you don't have to go that far back to find one. 2006 was like this.
Right,
And then we've had several years in a row that have not been like this. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that year because it was the year I gave away my snowblower to my...
Oh, yes. I remember hearing about that, as a matter of fact.
It was the year before the season started.
Yeah, and it just never stopped. That season just went on and on and on. That was really quite
remarkable. Oh, boy. A big mistake. Oh, Marcus in Green Bay has a question for you guys or comment. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. On a previous program, you guys mentioned an application for a smartphone where you can point it up towards the sky and it tells you what objects are up there. And I was wondering if you could give me that again. And then also in another program, you mentioned a website where a person could go to and really see what's going on with the weather up high, you know, the jet stream and stuff, where you can, I'm pretty sure you were able to, you know, just, you know, see the patterns and stuff, see what's going on and stuff. Is there something like that?
Yeah. I know the phone app for the star, the one that I have is called Star Guide. And that one, I'm pretty sure you can point up and I try it, but my battery is at 8%. So I'd probably kill it by trying to open it.
That sounds like a really worthwhile thing. That would be a really cool thing to have. The other, though, for jet stream and broad scale weather patterns, there's so many out there, but I'll give you the one that I think is the best one. It's our own department website, and the address is www.aos.wisc.gov. UW.edu. And then you'll get to the landing page there, and there are several options. You want to click on weather as one of the options on the left-hand side. And then you can either look at current observations. There's a on the next page, it'll be current observations, or current model forecasts. So that's numerical weather prediction forecasts. That'll show you the output from the models in really nice graphical display. So it's good pretty fun to explore.
Yep, thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we are on to Dick in Bark River, Michigan. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. This is somewhat different. I'll keep it short. 20 years ago, on the island of Maui, driving from sea level, Paia, to the top of Mount Haleakala, 10,025 feet, about at an altitude of 6,000 feet, and I have a witness. Hmm. We witnessed in the clear air up there below a triple rainbow, and I said, Toby, do you see that under the triple, the short, short, faint arc in the center of a fourth? Is that possible?
A triple rainbow is definitely possible.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about a quadruple, but a triple.
Just a tiny.
Yeah, they're very, very faint. I mean, if you look at the primary and the secondary is much fainter.
Yeah, the third one we saw was quite clear, but the fourth is it's an up in the air thing.
But,
okay.
You know, you're in the right place to look for it. You need big raindrops for that for three or four reflections inside, and so tropical.
Three is good enough, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Not many people have seen three.
No, that's right. Tropical raindrops are big enough.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have some photos up on our Facebook page. I hope you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page as you listen in here, because there is a fog bowl.
Mm-hmm. So that
and where is it now? I've got to find it. Oh blast! I was going to show you guys.
So is John?
Here's the photo of the fog bowl. Okay, I'll get that up here.
And as John was saying, if you get big drops, and then you can get those big multiple rainbows. But if you have small drops, like fog droplets are really small, then you can't even separate the colors out.
Yeah, it's real fuzzy, right? It's just kind of a bright bow,
So
just,
here it is.
It's over snow, huh?
Yeah.
It's over a snowfield.
So it's in New York.
Yeah, it was in the Arctic.
Yeah. Wow, how do you like that?
So it's a beautiful. Oh, actually, no. Well, yeah, it's at the North Pole is where it is.
So there
we go.
But looks like a white rainbow.
That might not even be fog, right? I mean, it's cold enough. It's not even fog. Technically, it's ice crystals.
No, but then you wouldn't get it. You need a sphere to get the bow shape.
That's so it's weird.
It must be super cold.
Yeah. Or it's a springtime picture at the North Pole.
Oh, that could be too. Yeah.
So it is 35 degrees or something, maybe.
Let's see if I can. If there's more here on the side, we can. It appears white because the water droplets in fog are much smaller than the raindrops, and as the drops get smaller, their colors disappear.
Yeah, they don't differentiate between
the colors are still there, you just can't see them.
Yeah, you can't pick them out.
Yeah.
So that is very...
That's really neat.
That is very cool. So, you want to see a fog bowl, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and we'll help you out.
It's too bad Dick didn't take a picture of the triple rainbow. That would have been...
I know. Yeah, that would have been awesome.
He probably didn't have a smartphone at the time.
You need a good camera, too.
Yeah, because you've got to let it expose for a long time, don't you, to collect all the light?
Yeah, to get that faint one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I have to get back to my... Oh, there I am. Back to my Facebook page. The regular page here. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have some questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we talk weather and climate with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. As we look back to over 2011, what are some of the kind of the significant weather events that stand out for you two?
I think there's national and international ones that are of really high profile. I think the Joplin tornado and the Tuscaloosa tornado, they were both in April of 2011, are pretty standout events. Texas wildfires were a standout event.
Yeah. Around here, I kind of like the water spouts. We had the water spouts on Lake Monona, water spout on Lake Michigan.
Yep.
I guess there was a couple on
Lake Michigan. Yeah, and those water spouts on Lake Michigan were in September.
Right, that's right. Mm-hmm. They were late in the season.
Yeah. And there was a water spot in Monona as
well? Yeah, like in June, I think there was.
Yeah, I remember seeing the picture of that.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
Neither did
visually.
I
was really bummed.
And it was kind of near the end of the work day, too, on a June day, I think, about 5 o'clock-ish. If we had just, I don't do this every day, but if I had just gone up to the roof at the end of the day and looked out
right.
to the east,
yep.
I would have seen it.
Yeah.
But I didn't, so I didn't.
Yeah. So they're amazing. I've seen one in Florida once, and boy, they're just, I mean, they're not that dangerous like tornadoes,
yeah.
but man, they are scary.
They're too dramatic to look at, I bet.
Dramatic.
Yeah, I've never seen one. I've seen steam devils, you know.
I wouldn't want to be out on the boat, though. I
mean, yeah, no.
No, or if it's going a different way, I wouldn't, let me rephrase that. I wouldn't want to be out in a small boat.
Yeah, right.
I'd rather be out in a rowboat.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you'd probably be okay if you stayed away from it, even in a pretty small boat. But
yeah, but that's always that risk.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Who wants to test it?
No, not me.
See if the weather guys are right. Let's row into this.
Or canoe into this. Oh, boy. Terry and Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
My call. Larry, I want to thank you for going green and giving up your snowblower. That was a great thing for you to do.
Okay. I think it's just in repair, actually.
His back's out, but
yeah, right.
My grandson's question, basically from last night, we were coming back from Opaca, going east on Highway 10, heading for Appleton. So up in the sky, it was a clear night, there were stars out, but he saw an object, and he says, Grandpa, what is that? It was kind of a flashing, like a red and blue and green light, but it seemed to be stationary at about, as we're heading east, at about the 3 o'clock position, if you were to do a large sphere.
Mm-hmm.
In front of you, or like a clock in front of you as you're driving east.
Yeah.
Yeah, a point of light or a region of light?
Well, it was a point of light. And it seemed to have like a sparkly tail, and I didn't know if it was Santa Claus returning to the North Pole after doing his deliveries, or if it could have been a satellite or a space lab. So.
Hmm.
Yeah, the satellites would be moving pretty fast. When you see satellites, they're going across the sky pretty quick.
Yeah, if you're driving, though, you might not be able to detect that. It's possible.
Oh,
right?
That's true. That could be, yeah.
Yeah, we did stop at a couple of locations and watch it. It didn't seem to be moving.
Wow, weird.
Wow.
When I used to look at the stars a lot when I was a kid, and it was more obvious in the wintertime, so this would have been like what you had last night. Certain celestial bodies, I can't remember what they are now. Maybe they're quasars or some other kind of thing. They actually do have alternating colors of light, but they're usually really faint. So I don't know if they'd be the kind that would attract your attention while you're driving. So
Well, it didn't attract my attention. It attracted my grandson. He's the one who picked it up. So
yeah, it's really interesting. I wish I knew the answer to that.
Yeah,
I don't.
All right, thanks for your tip. And Larry, what are you giving up this summer? The lawnmower?
Actually, we gave up. My wife insisted that we give up our power mower, and she volunteered to mow the lawn every day with our push mower, or every week. But somehow, the pushing of the lawnmower has fallen to me.
Oh, I wouldn't have seen that coming.
Well, actually, she does do it sometimes.
Who would have guessed?
Well, your wife is an excellent delegator and way to step up to the job.
Right.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Mike and Ladysmith, hello to you.
Hi. By the way, the quasars are the ones that flash. But
is that right?
I would not expect that they would be very bright.
Yeah, because they're faint, right?
Yeah, usually, because they're usually in other like galaxies and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, I've been in a water spout.
Have you?
County in the early 90s, we were fishing in Sawyer Harbor, a friend of mine and I had a 16-foot smoker craft at the time, and we were trolling for walleyes, and it's summer. I don't remember the exact month. I would guess probably July or somewhere in that time frame. Anyway, there was some weather coming, and we were being mindful of it, but the fish were biting, and so anyway, we're having a little bit of a dry spot. So both him and I were rummaging around in our tackle boxes and, just kind of looking forward every once in a while to make sure we weren't running into something, but we weren't looking backward. And at one point, my buddy there figured out what plug he was going to put on the line, and he turns around and He goes, oh, well.
Yeah.
Let your imagination run wild.
Insert the word there. And just literally within only maybe 50 or 60 yards away, there's a water spout coming right at us.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was nothing we could do. And it took the boat and flipped it. Or I didn't say flipped it. It spun it. Mm. A full 360 degrees.
Wow.
Wow.
And we had to kill the engine because, of course, we had just then got wrapped up in all of our lines.
Yeah.
Oh,
And then the rains just...
Wow. That is awesome. What was the name of the boat? No Place Like Home or something like that?
I got rid of that boat. I figured it was unlucky.
That is awesome.
So did you get wet from the water spout, too?
Well, we got wet because I don't know if we got wet from the water spout as much as we got wet from
the rain that followed.
It picked you up very cleanly and turned you around.
Yeah.
It was, a wall of water splashing and.
Wow.
And then the rain hit right after that. So, we got wet from the splashing about and then.
But you didn't feel like you were getting sucked out or pulled out of the boat.
Well, it's hard to say because the one thing that left an impression on me is that it's not like a cartoon tornado, if you were. It seemed to be more like a, I don't know, I'm going to throw a term out here that I'm not sure is correct, but it seemed like more like a distribution of water that was going up. So it was like, there was like it was thin and it got thicker and then it got thinner and.
Oh, right, so yeah.
It wasn't really like, you got hit with a sheet of water.
Wow. That is just amazing.
It is.
Yeah.
That is.
And I think, you think about that, it probably makes sense because there's probably a pressure differential across the surface of the water, and it's going to be sucking up the water at a different rate.
Yeah, that's
where the pressure wave is. So.
You're right. It's a vortex structure that has a central minimum in pressure, and it fluctuates. It's not constant. You're right.
And do you remember what direction you spun the boat was spun around? Was it spun in a counterclockwise or clockwise direction?
I don't.
You weren't thinking about that.
Yeah.
You really should have been taking notes.
Yeah. I think the phrase, if I can, well, maybe I can't say it, but there was something about, bend over and.
Goodbye. Oh, Mike, thank you so much.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that is a great story. I'm so glad to have that story. Jeez. Ah, man. And we've got more stories ahead. Mark in Iowa County is coming up next, but Steve Ackerman, John Martin, they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk weather and climate with them. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with my guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Mark in Iowa County up next. Mark, hello. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I'm from Massachusetts a few decades ago, and I'll try not to let that accent out.
Well, why not? Wait a minute now. Hold on a minute.
I bring it back every time I listen to them.
Yeah, good. You should not be ashamed of that. That's a mark of intelligence.
There were a few calls back. A man was talking about a light out, I believe he said to the east, and I think actually, as a result of the wonderful weather we're having, evening and morning astronomy has been terrific.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that might be the star Sirius.
That's okay. A bright star. It's the brightest one, right?
It's a very bright star, and it shows some different colors, too. I forget why. It's easy to find. As Orion rises in the east, kind of on its side, if you follow the three belt stars down to the horizon, eventually Sirius rises next in Canis Major, the dog star.
Okay, I think that sounds like the same direction, right? Because you said they were heading towards Appleton, going east, and it was like 3 o'clock.
And it's at 3 o'clock, in the sky, yeah.
And there's some marvelous planets right now. Jupiter's high in the south in the evening. Venus is setting in the southwest in the evening. And in the morning, Mercury is great this week. It's hard to find because it's always toward the sun. Saturn is high in the south next to Spica, the star. I think I said that right. And then Mars is below Leo. So about 6:30 in the morning, about 5:30 in the evening. Great stuff to
great
see.
Same,
yeah,
great
I've never
to
seen
watch.
Mercury. I'd like to see Mercury.
Yeah.
This week.
This is the week to do it, John.
Yes, no, I'm going to have to make sure I do it.
It's up and
stay
down
clear.
In just a few days sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
Thanks, Mark.
Oh,
yeah,
thanks
that's
for your great show.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Great callers. I always have great callers. Marion Minocqua wonders, what is the next chance of snow for either northern or southern Wisconsin?
Well, I guess I'd have to ask, what do you mean by snow? It's going to flurry here a couple of times this week, it looks like, through maybe about Friday. We'll have two or three bouts of
light snow. But you wouldn't call that snow, would
no,
you?
No, I don't think in either case it'll accumulate. And I think that's probably true also in northern Wisconsin this week.
Okay.
It looks like a pretty dry week. They may have a better chance of getting an inch or so, you know, at Minocqua or places like that or a little bit north, but along about Tuesday or Wednesday. But really, that's about it.
Well, there you
go.
It's
not a good, not a good picture. Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Dolores in Kenosha, on to you. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, good morning. You've been talking about the water spouts, and I was wondering if the phenomena we had last late spring, early summer here in Kenosha was a water spout coming in off the lake. A violent wind came through. Now, I work at the hospital down on the lakefront, and some of the girls on the upper floors actually, they heard it, and they saw the trees being uprooted and folding over along the lakefront. And it came in near my neighborhood, which is a little further out from the lake, took trees out, folded them across the roadways, and then it was gone. I was asleep because I worked nights, and my husband said it didn't even last a full minute. But it took out the power. It just, this came through.
Is this the end of June?
Oldest, yes, one of the oldest neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And there was a tree that had to be 4 feet in diameter that was totally uprooted. But then it had this had the huge canopy.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was a you know, we have these thunderstorms, and one type of thunderstorm is called a supercell. And you can imagine why we call it a supercell. It's like right, they're just giant thunderstorms. And you had one hit the lakeshore front of Kenosha area in June 30th. In fact, that's one of the memorable events for this year. And there were 80-mile-per-hour winds. So I don't think what was knocking the trees down and the power lines down were water spouts, because they're generally pretty weak.
Yeah,
it was just downflow winds.
Yeah, these were straight line winds too, from the gust front of a thunderstorm, which is different from the rotary winds of a tornado. So really interesting. It sure doesn't matter that much if you got property that has a bunch of trees on it and they happen to fall on your fence or your house. You don't care exactly why it fell down, but that was the case in this one. This is amazing. This is a story at the Weather Service website of this event that you're recalling.
I'll have to look that one up.
It was
something else. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to that's amazing. Josh in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. Hi. Yeah, I guess more on that same theme of extreme weather. It seems like it's been a really big year for extreme weather events. And I was reading Jeff Master's blog on the Wanderground, and he was looking back at the year and said there were $1 billion extreme weather events in the U.S.
I'm sorry. I missed part of that. There were...
$12 billion extreme weather events in the U.S. in 2011. Mm. It sounded like Texas got hit really hard with 8 of those.
Wow.
I'm wondering if Wisconsin, if it's been an expensive year more so than others in Wisconsin, how we fared.
I guess I don't know off the top of my head. I'm thinking anecdotally here over the last 4 or 5 years. We had the Lake Delton flood 1 year. We had the floods in August of 2007, not long ago. I think we've had worse years for weather damage in our state than 2011. We were relatively spared compared to many of our neighboring states in the Union this year, but that's not always been the case. But that's my sense. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, you think of the ones that really do the damage, and it's like flooding or tornadoes. We've had a lot of tornadoes in 2011, but I don't think they hit like forests and things like that.
They didn't
do as much damage monetarily wise.
Yeah, in Missouri and in Alabama, they hit big cities.
Big cities, that was expensive.
So they would cost a lot and a lot of lives.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling. And you can join in too, by the way. We have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. What stands out in your memory as a significant weather event in 2011? Or I'm wondering how closely you monitor forecasts. You plan things out around them or just take the weather as it comes? Carl in Beaver Dam, it is your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I'd like to get your guest's opinion on the release of methane in the from the Arctic tundra and the Arctic seabed. As I understand it, it's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and that there's a lot of it that's been locked up in the tundra, frozen in place and under the seabeds too for thousands of years. And what will happen if it's released, as it seems like there's, I've read something about some of it's been released already. I kind of envision a scenario where you get more global warming because of that, and then it then in turn melts more of the tundra and get this feedback mm-hmm. loop, it seems like. Well, what's their opinion on it?
Yeah, what's your opinion, guys?
Yeah, it's beyond the realm of opinion. That's a fact, that as the tundra thaws, in most likely in response to a change in the climate and in a small change in the temperature that extends the season of thawing, that adds more methane to the atmosphere. And methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, which you keep increasing the fraction of it in our atmosphere and you have dire consequences for enhancing the warming. I think it has 100-year or more than that residence time in the atmosphere.
It stays around,
takes a long time to get rained out or you know chemically taken out. So that's a very serious problem. The caller is exactly right.
Yeah, and again, greenhouse gas is one that is transparent to solar energy, so it doesn't absorb solar energy. And what it absorbs is energy that the surface emits because of its temperature. And methane absorbs in a different spectral region than carbon dioxide. So it's still enhancing the absorption that way. And there was a great study that I read of, there's this woman scientist studying methane bubbles coming out of lakes in Siberia.
Oh, yeah.
And there were some photos, it might have been Science Magazine or it might have been the New York Times science section, I forget where, but there's some great photos of these bubbles that are just bubbling out of lakes. And it's so, you know, so Siberia, wintertime, and the bubbling is so active that the lake sections of that lake are not freezing, you know, because it's just bubbling up like boiled water. It just keeps it from freezing. It's continually moving.
Wow. Weird.
So, yeah, so there's evidence, as John was saying, that the methane is coming out as the regions warm up.
And that's one of the things that that has people alarmed about what will happen at high latitudes, both hemispheres, mostly, though, the northern hemisphere, is that once it starts to warm past a certain threshold of warming, there'll be a lot of positive feedbacks that exacerbate it, make it worse, and more so in the high latitudes than in the low latitudes.
Yeah,
because water is the main greenhouse gas that'll be affected in the low latitudes, but it gets rained out every 9 days.
Right.
So it's not quite as disastrous to add a new water vapor into the atmosphere as it is methane vapor. That's bad news.
We have other callers online. I want to go to our phones here. John and Seneca actually phoned in and asked, is the space lab visible? Heard that it's visible in the northwest sky around 6 p.m.
It's visible. I'm not sure where it is at this time of the year. But yeah, you can see it. It tracks across. It looks like a star, really kind of a bright star that just tracks across the sky. And you know it's so the spacecraft or because of the speed that it's moving. It's moving pretty quickly across the sky.
We used to see Skylab.
Skylab was the other one. That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd see Skylab go by when I was looking at the stars or something.
Dave in southern Wisconsin, on to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Fantastic show, as always, with these guys. Quick question. We talk about the amount of, you know, the total amount of snowfall, but ecologically, there's a real issue with the length of time the surface of the ground is covered with snow because it buffers for extreme temperatures and things like that. And it also makes a difference on the amount of reflected light, which is really influential on people with seasonal affective disorder. So I'm wondering, have people looked at the length of time the ground is actually covered with snow versus, you know, just knowing the amount of snow that's fallen over a season?
They keep statistics on all of that. How deep the snow is, what the number of snowfalls are greater than 4 inches,
yeah.
How long the ground is covered. For the reasons you're pointing out, it's important for both solar energy being reflected out to space and thus causing nighttime minimum temperatures being really cold, as well as insulating the surface.
Yeah, if Steve's right. If you look at the climate record for any sort of first order station like Madison, Milwaukee, Wausau, they'll have not only the high temperature, low temperature for the day, wind speed and direction, and all those other variables, how much snow or other kind of precipitation might have fallen. In the wintertime, they'll give you a daily snow depth measurement so that you can keep track of you know, if you wanted to decide that it was interesting to you how many days in the wintertime have an inch or more of snow on the ground. It's easy to recall and figure that out.
Yeah.
So those are important things, as you point out.
One quick other question, if I could. The issue of carbon black and its impact on climate change. We rarely hear about it, but I know there's some research being done, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right, thanks for calling.
Yeah,
carbon
I know
black.
They look at that from, carbon black absorbs a lot, but it generally falls out of the atmosphere pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So the issue is, speaking of snowfall, is when it falls on snowfall or ice sheets like up in Greenland, it lowers the albedo and it absorbs more solar energy on those ice sheets, which tends to enhance in the melting of it.
Yeah, yeah. And you can even see that on your street, you know, like
oh,
in
right,
Madison.
Yeah,
if you get one little piece of the blacktop exposed on the third day after a snowfall, the whole street will just melt within that next sunny day.
In fact, we have an obscenely long driveway.
Is it?
And when we get a small, like a quarter of an inch or a half an inch of snow, I just run crisscrosses through the driveway with my snow shovel.
See, he's a radiation guy. He knows what to do. Let the sun do the work.
Right, let the sun do the work.
That up is
the tar
a very
and
good
melt
idea.
Everything.
That's great.
And we've had a couple of those snowfalls recently.
Yeah, right. Just etch things out. You know, you could write your name and stuff like that.
So, if you ever see Steve doing that, don't.
Right, there's a reason.
Do not have the nerve to say, "What in tarnation are you doing?" He'll tell you.
I am not lazy.
Oh, man. Well, Peter in Eau Claire has a question for you guys. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I have a question kind of related to ice formation. Just wondering, when the... Well, it's obvious that early in the season, the ice is most dangerous, but I was wondering if there's any sort of resource, you know, if I'm going to go out to an unfamiliar lake, if there's any sort of spring maps, because I know those are little danger spots, and just kind of what are some of the aspects of the weather that, you know, really impacts how dangerous the ice is, and is certain spots worse than others?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
I'll take my question off the air.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know about springs maps. That would be really
useful. I'd look at the DNR.
They might have that,
Some of those geological maps have where springs come in. But if you don't have snow, you know, again, back to snow. If you don't have snow on the lake so it's clear ice, that's going to help melt the ice below because it warms the water below it, particularly if you have water flow underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You need, I don't know what the exact rule of thumb is, what DNR might say, but I'd say you probably need 5 nights in a row with temperatures below 10 degrees or something before you can trust ice on a lake, and especially that's away from springs. So,
and there are some fishing sites where they post how deep the ice is from the fishing guys record it, which is kind of nice.
But rivers are
scary.
I would never go on a moving water underneath. And for me, even today, it's certainly true when I was a kid, that the best resource I think you could appeal to is a giant rock. And you just do the best you can to throw it on the ice near the shore and see if it does anything. And if that was the first test that we would do when we were kids, and it usually worked okay, but... there's bound to be better stuff nowadays than big rocks.
Than a giant rock. Oh, man.
I used a pole once when I walked out with my brother onto the mouth of the Yahara River when I first lived on the lake, not knowing how stupid that was. The pole went right through the ice, and then I realized, oh, I'm in trouble.
Back up slowly.
Right.
Jim and Wanakee, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Have a question about the impact of all these, like especially at the holiday season, all this jet flight, so these vapors and so forth, in terms of that as a form of transportation, is that having an effect on climate change? I mean, there's just a great number of jets all over the world, and
in the air at one time, sure.
Yeah.
And I had talked, I remember working with a World War II vet, and he had said that he thought that had he had been a pilot during World War II, and he thought that that had something to do with, you know, the global warming kind of a thing.
Mm. Yeah,
what is your opinion on that?
There's two things that people get concerned about with high-altitude jets. One is, as you're talking about with regard to engine exhaust, and particularly if they're flying in the stratosphere, which is up about, what, 10, 12 kilometers from here?
Yeah. And most jets going across the country do get it.
Do that, particularly if they go across the poles. And the stratosphere is very stable, so any kind of chemistry that come or chemicals that come out the back engine tend to stay around. The other thing is when they generate contrails, and those contrails can enhance cloud cover over a region, and that can lead to primarily, if I remember right, kind of upping the nighttime temperature minimums, warming it up a little bit statistically.
There you go.
Interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Jamie from our posted on our Facebook page. He was writing from Berkeley, California for the holidays. Where is the snow in the Midwest? Will we get any? Warm and dry still? It is warm and dry.
You know, we're getting to the end of December, and we haven't had any significant snow here. And that takes one-third, I think, of the winter right out of the picture, because I think it's the snowiest month of the year is December for Madison. I don't know if that's true generally across the state, but it certainly is for us. And it's not going to have any. So I don't know what to say. I think that can set the stage for a relatively depressed snowfall for this whole season.
Emily was also on the Facebook page, said, could you explain why the Arctic cold air is being trapped in Siberia, giving us and Northern Europe milder temperatures?
I'd like to be able to say I knew why. I'm just beginning a new research venture where I'm trying to identify objectively the positions of the polar and the subtropical jet every day, four times a day with gridded data. And I wish I knew what a normal December looked like from this perspective. I don't, but I'll tell you right now, there's almost no evidence of the polar jet in the month of December, which is very unusual.
Really?
Yes. The jet across the Pacific is entirely, in at least in our identification scheme, a subtropical jet. There's polar influence in the Western Hemisphere right now. And so maybe that's an unusual circumstance, which would lead to this relatively unusual circumstance. I don't know.
Wow.
It's very curious at a minimum. Yeah.
Very curious and very interesting. Our weather guy's with us, and they'll be here right up until 12:30 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys from the UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Great to have you listening in. Thank you so much. Call us if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page. You can post there. We'd love to see pictures or questions at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Love to have that. I have a question from Michael from our Facebook page. I have a question for the weather guys. Is Wisconsin in a La Nina this winter season with all the fronts coming in from the Gulf of Mexico and the Santa Ana winds? Where is the, we were just talking about it, where is the Canada jet stream? Has it fallen too far south or has it not fallen at all?
Yeah, we are in a La Nina year, but if you think back to or listen to the show from last month, we kept talking about how the La Nina year was going to drive our temperatures below normal. But it hasn't happened.
No.
And what we're finding now is what I would call confusion, because some models are predicting that La Nina is going to strengthen, and others are predicting that it's not going to strengthen. So it's up in the air, I think, in terms of what the heck's going to go on this winter.
Yeah, me too. And this might possibly be tied to the last comment we had a chance to make about the jet, which related to this next question, is that the normal condition is that the convection in the tropics in the Pacific Ocean is on the western side of the Pacific. And the El Nino, the opposite of what we have now, tends to shift it to the center of the Pacific Basin. Mm-hmm. So a La Nina maybe enhances it a little bit, where it normally is already strong. That might be what keeps this subtropical component of the jet so strong, and keeps the polar part of it in absentia right now.
Yeah,
so I don't know if that's what's going on. But what's really interesting is that this issue, when you look outside and you see that you don't have any snow and it's December 27th or whatever it is, 26th, and you wonder about that, This might have something to do with how the weather has been playing out in the last 6 or 8 weeks in the tropical West Pacific. And it might be a very clear connection that we're just beginning now to understand, which is really cool.
Yeah.
It makes the science even more interesting than it was already.
Alan Baraboo, we're going to go to you. Hi, Al.
Hi, how's it going today? I have a question about the Arctic Oscillation. As a winter weather weenie, I'm kind of hoping it goes negative. Do you know maybe if that's going to happen? And I hear rumors of possible stratospheric warming event. I'll let you guys take that one.
Yeah, I wish I knew more about all of these various oscillations. I have to tell you, to me, they have the whiff of mythology. Only from this perspective, the idea that these connections are the key to understanding what's going to happen in the next 6 to 10 days. I'm not so sure that's really true. But on the other hand, there's undeniable statistical evidence that suggests that when you have one of these, especially the Atlantic Oscillation and the Arctic Oscillation, in one phase or the other, there's a tendency for weather to have a certain distribution across North America. I am not aware, though, of what are the ingredients to flipping the switch from one phase to the other. I think that's one of the big questions about a lot of these things is what are the circumstances that lead to a shift in phase of one of these global scale oscillatory circulation features. I don't know what the answer is to that.
Hmm. Yeah, when I was looking at the seasonal forecast, they're primarily talking about La Nina. They're not talking about the Arctic oscillation. So, which to me would suggest that probably it isn't going to change.
Yeah, maybe that's right.
There's stratospheric sudden warmings. We haven't had one of those in a while, I think.
Yeah, several years, I think. In the late 90s was one good one.
Yeah, it's like 2006, 2007. It's pretty hardcore warm December, too. And you guys bring up the MJO, the forcing in the Pacific. That's pretty interesting about how it, can mitigate all the way in northern latitudes and affect the weather. Well,
yeah, I think it really can. We're just trying to figure that out better than we ever have, and we're in the initial stages of that. But I think there's a connection there, and the answer is pending.
Mm-hmm. All right. I appreciate the answers to my questions, and you guys have a great Christmas holiday.
Yeah, thank you. You too, Al. Thank you. Alan in Madison, it's on to you now. Hi, Alan.
Yes. My question is not exactly seasonal, but I have a question about the heat index. I understand the wind chill that has to do with evaporation from the skin, and I think, I can see how you can get an absolute measurement of the effective temperature by measuring the temperature on the skin. But the heat index, I don't understand how the absolute temperature that they give on the weather programs is valid. I know it has to do with lack of evaporation because of the humidity, but do they actually get an absolute temperature off of the skin? I wouldn't think so.
No, they do a theoretical calculation based on how fast the body can cool down. So the temperature of the heat index is, and I don't remember, it's kind of, it's related to what would your temperature of your body be like if the relative humidity was some certain amount, not what it is currently. And I don't remember if that relative humidity is like 50% or 60%.
It's probably in that range. I bet that's right.
So it's really kind of tells you what your body would feel like if you had different relative humidity conditions and the same air temperature.
Yeah. How do they know what the body would feel like?
Well, when you, based on the high relative humidity of the conditions that prompt the warning, they can say the primary mechanism by which your body loses heat is through evaporation. And if that's not available because the air around your body is already saturated with water, then it doesn't take very long for your body to start increasing its internal temperature. And that is reflected in what you would feel like if you still had the ability to perspire, but the air temperature was 107. Yeah. So they make that calculation based on your inability to lose heat by evaporation off your skin.
So that's a real valid reading.
Yeah, I'd say it's close to the ballpark. Everybody's going to be a little different. Some people have a little more or a little less salt in their sweat, so that's going to make some difference in the evaporation. But I'd bet that covers people pretty broadly.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Mike wondering why there is generally a delay in the warmest weather after the summer solstice and colder weather after the winter solstice. Now, he's talking about delay.
Mm. Seasonal temperature lag.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, we have that January thaw.
Yeah.
But that's a month after.
Yeah, I think maybe this question is about why is the, you know, if you take all 50 states, for instance, and this is kind of old data. I got this book in the mid-80s. But at that time, 38 out of the 50 states had their coldest all-time temperature more than 3 weeks after the winter solstice. And then the same is true for their all-time highs is more than 3 weeks after the summer solstice. I think it has to do with the lag in temperature to sun has to do with thermal inertia of the oceans, especially, and various other things.
So it's all about, even though the sun is going down sooner or later, depending on what solstice, it's all about still energy gains versus what your energy losses
exactly
are.
Right.
So it's related to generally maximum temperatures occur after local noon,
right,
which is when the sun is up its highest.
Right.
And minimum temperatures generally occur just after sunrise.
In the seasonal change is guided by roughly the same principle. It's kind of interesting. It's counterintuitive at first, but when you think about it, it isn't. That, as you said, you know, at noontime on a given day, that's the most intense incoming solar radiation. But it's not going to be until a couple of hours later that the ground's warm enough to start emitting enough radiation of its own kind to be equal to the amount that's now diminished that's coming in from the sun. And then in the next second, the ground's emitting more than the sun's sending to the ground, and that's when the temperature stops rising.
Yeah.
Because you're losing more than you're gaining for the rest of the day.
Yeah. So it's all about gains and losses.
Yeah, it is. It's a ledger sheet, no doubt.
Yeah.
We have on Facebook, Kathy, this goes back to an earlier question, too. She Facebooked us. It says, what are chemtrails? Conspiracy or not?
Conspiracy and imagination.
Yes, they're a conspiracy. Things actually do come out of engines, as Steve mentioned earlier. You know, you get propellants and various things that can form clouds of ice or water droplets. But there's no dastardly plot going on, and it would be impossible to mount such a plot. That's why we can say, I think, with confidence that it's a conspiracy theory, because the atmosphere is so vast. It weighs 6 million billion tons. There's no way that the Air Force clandestinely could be polluting it to a degree that actually allows them to predict the outcome of their pollution. It's not plausible.
Yeah. And those contrails that form out of jets, the back of jets, are very similar to the breath that you see on a cold day. I mean, it's the basic thing. You got the warm, moist air coming out of your lungs, mixing with cold air, and boom, you generate a cloud that, in our case, from our breath, evaporates real quick.
Yeah.
But in jets, it could stay around for a while.
Let's go to Will in Madison. Will, hello.
Hello, gentlemen. I've been on this topic for many, many years. I've got four published books on this, self-published. One of them is a title, Our Secret Origins, History Exposed to Save Humanity, and a subtitle, Soon Megastorms, Sun Megaflares, and Warm Age. You gentlemen mentioned something about those bubbles coming up in that Siberian lake. Mm-hmm. Now, those bubbles are coming up not because of methane up in the high latitudes or wherever, but because of the Earth's core heating up. Occasionally, it heats up more. It stores energy. We don't know why it gets hot, but it just keeps storing, getting hotter and hotter. And eventually, the heat starts coming up through the various layers of density magma. And just like thunderstorms, billow up through our atmosphere, higher and higher. And then it comes to the surface. Now, that glacial lake out there in Siberia, the bottom is probably being heated up by one of these billows coming up.
Well, okay. What do you think of that?
Well, that might well be true. But if that lake is emitting methane because of whatever's going on under the surface, that undeniably changes the radiative balance of the overlying atmosphere in a way that we don't want to have happening, because we're not, you know, in control of that, and it's going to start to increase the retention of outgoing infrared energy, which will warm the planet. So that may well be an underlying cause, but it's contributing to a problem that we're addressing broadly. Mm-hmm. That is greenhouse warming of the planet.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. What? Recently we had a full lunar eclipse.
Yeah, and you know, we just missed it.
I know.
Yeah, it just set just before it turned total.
Yeah, we were talking about that one day, weren't we? That I hadn't gotten up, and you had said something like you wanted to get up and see it, or I can't remember.
I got up and actually saw a part of it.
I didn't even do it.
But you know, the thing was, we were at AGU, a conference out in San Francisco, and in San Francisco, you could see it. Total eclipse at like 6 in the morning. So you had a couple of hours actually to watch it. And I don't know why we didn't stay out an extra day and, you know, take a personal holiday and see it a little bit.
Because it was beautiful when we were there. It was clear every day, every morning, which is not particularly usual for San Francisco in early December.
Yeah, but if you got up really early in the morning, just as the moon was setting, you could see it was like somebody took a bite out of it.
I wish I'd seen that.
Yeah.
But you were sleeping.
I was sleeping or I was doing something else. I did see a total lunar eclipse once when I was a kid, and it glowed like a red coal.
Yeah.
That was really intense. And I had to stay up till about 1 a.m. to see that, but I couldn't do that
now. Anne and I were visiting England when I saw my first lunar eclipse. Yeah. And actually, we had parked by a Druid site.
Oh,
to watch it. Right. And there was a whole bunch of commotion going on. And Anne wanted to go see it. And I was like, we're supposed to have, like, burning people.
Yeah, right.
let's just watch it from here. But it turned this glowing red. It was really
something.
On that note, we'll take a short break. We'll be back. Stay with us. Taking a look at weather and climate for the next 30 minutes with our weather guys from the UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Great to have them along and great to have you listening in. And if you have a question for them about weather or climate, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Also, you can go to my Facebook page and post there at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to have you do that as well. Click like while you're there, and we'll send you updates on our programs and all the different activities, things that we're doing. So while you're at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And David Appleton is online with a question, so let's go right there to Dave. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I don't want to open up a can of worms on the global warming thing. I just want to confirm the prior caller, your guest had kind of acknowledged that there's a possibility that the lakes and northern climes, permafrost areas, are warming up because of the heating of the core, and that's causing the release of methane. I just want to, if that's true, I want to know about that because I haven't heard about that before, and I thought that that's what I got from the prior caller.
Yeah, no, most of the thermofrost that's warming up is due from air temperatures warming things up that then warm the ground up, not from below.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for clarifying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Terry in Zion, Illinois, on to you. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I just have a simple question, and I don't know if anybody's ever looked at it from this point of view, but looking at the Earth as sort of like a motor or engine and taking consideration all the oil that's been extracted out of the Earth for as many years as it has been, and looking at oil as sort of like a lubricant or a coolant for the Earth, has any scientists or anybody been looking at it from that point of view as a cost, maybe a partial cost to global warming?
Not as a lubricant. I mean.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think the oil that's in natural gas that's in the Earth is all a result of, you know, prior organic material that existed at other times in the history of the Earth, and it's just been subjected to pressures and in various other processes that have, you know, transformed it into petroleum-type products or natural gas. I don't think there's any anything except oxidation of those products that lends their existence to contributing to global warming. So it's not until we extract them and burn them that we have any concern about their presence as a factor in changing the climate.
Yeah.
Okay, great. That was just a question I kind of had going through my head. So
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Good.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it, Terry. And let's go to Justin. Justin in Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Hi. So I have a question. My dad grew up in Arkansas. And he talked a lot about a weather phenomenon called fire fox. He said that when it gets foggy, sometimes you would see what looks like glowing eyes on top of a stump or something. And my question is, have you ever heard of this phenomenon? And if you have, what could possibly cause it? And apparently it would only happen when it's foggy.
Wow, no, I have not. No. What did you call it? Fire fox or?
That's apparently what the locals called it. They called it fire fox. my dad says he's seen it, apparently he's seen it himself a few times. It would only be at night when it's foggy, and, like, you'd look at, like, a stump or something in the dark, and what would look like glowing eyes would appear. You know, you'd see what could be mistaken for, like, glowing eyes. The locals called it fire fog.
This is without illuminating the darkness with a flashlight or a torch or something?
I'm assuming so. I'm honestly not sure of those kinds of details.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. It seemed to me in the absence of a light source, I don't know how you'd get a concentration of light coming toward you unless it was emanating from something.
It could have been with, like, a light or something. I was just curious if maybe you've heard of something like that or not.
I haven't.
Yeah, no.
Because maybe you could have, like, something like a fog bowl that has a diffraction around the tree stump or something that causes something weird to happen.
Oh, like a halo,
you know?
Type
thing. Right.
Yeah.
If you're illuminating it.
Yeah, illuminating it from behind, so somebody else would be illuminating
it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know.
I'd stay out of that fog.
Yeah, me too. Like the doctor says, don't go to those places.
thanks for calling, Justin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Oh, you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We were talking earlier about full lunar eclipse, and somebody was wondering what exactly is a full lunar eclipse or what's going on and how visible was it in the Midwest, the upper Midwest?
What the full lunar eclipse is when the moon completely goes into the Earth's shadow. And what happens then is that you would think it would go completely dark, but at sunset, you know how the sky turns red? And that's by a process we call scattering. All the blue light gets scattered. And so the red light kind of gets around Earth and gets to the dark side of Earth and illuminates where the moon is. So it takes on this really blood red type color. In the Midwest, you could only see a partial eclipse, which means that the only part of the moon is shadowed by the Earth's surface.
Yeah.
And generally, that a lot of times looks not really deep red. It kind of just looks like a shadow with a tinge of red to it, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was a little orangey. We had a partial eclipse here not long ago. And in fact, it was in the wintertime, two or three winters ago. And I remember watching it from my driveway, and it was kind of orangey. Yeah, the little bit that was bitten out of the moon.
Yeah.
It's nothing like the red glowing coal. That's awesome. Right.
Sarah in Rushford has a comment for us on Firefox, I believe. Hi, Sarah.
If your caller had seen something glowing on a stump in the dark, there's a good chance that was from a phosphorescent fungus, not a weather event.
Cool.
Cool. What drives them? Does it have to be a freshly cut stump or?
I don't think so. It's something that grows on it over time.
A stump that had been sitting there a long time.
Yeah.
I actually thought of that when.
Interesting. And do they react? Does this stuff react better if the relative humidity is really high in terms of phosphorescence?
It might. I really don't know a lot about it. It's just something I had heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Interesting. That was in the back of my mind too, Sarah. So thanks for calling. Appreciate it. I didn't want to spew it out there and then be thought an idiot. Sarah at least knows what
she's talking about.
Now I can see. Yeah, I thought that too. But I did. I did. Oh, man. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. Lightning sprites. Do we talk about those?
Not yet. But, they're...
National Geographic has posted some really amazing weather photos, and they recently featured one that was of lightning sprites. What are they in?
We know what they are. We don't know what causes them. And I think there's a field program going on right now to actually study them. I think it's coming out of Japan. But they usually affect, I think they only occur over thunderstorms. And the electrical activity within the thunderstorm somehow excites the air that's, 30 to 50 miles up above. And then it glows a red color in terms of sprites. But there are also blue...
Dwarves
and elves, and there's all kinds of stuff that occurs on the top of thunderstorms that we only discovered in the late 1980s. So we only known about it for 20 years.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. Apparently the pilots, like the U-2 pilots, had seen it, but they never said anything. And I'm not sure why, if they were told not to say anything or if they just thought maybe it was their imagination, because they only last like tenths of a millisecond. So it's in the blink of an eye, they're there. You got to be in the right spot at the right time, look in the right direction in order to see it.
And these Beast Boy guys are hyper-vigilant, you know, they're YouTube pilots, and they don't want to be taken off their mission, so
they
can't be reporting some lightning from 100 miles away from a thunderstorm.
Steven Krivitz, on to you. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Question, I've gone to Paulding, Michigan several times and observed what's called the Paulding Lights.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't. What are they?
Well, the Paulding Lights is a phenomenon that occurs at the end of a old railroad bed, which is now a DNR trail.
Yeah, Watersmead is the town that it's normally associated with,
Yep, absolutely. So what it is then, I've been watching it for 25, 30 years. It's a light that comes straight up out of a swamp. It begins as one bright orb of brilliant white light, comes straight up, hovers, 2 seconds go by, and it splits up into three different types of lights, a red, a yellow, and a green, which then proceed to kind of hover around their own little directions, and then they all recombine back into this white light and go straight back down.
Wow. So is that another chemical luminescence type thing, or if it's occurring above a swamp? Or
you're there, some freak out in the swamp, I don't know, but it's been going on for 20, 30 years, so I just want to know if you guys are anything about it.
But it's another spot I'd avoid.
Actually, what I've heard is that it actually is lights from a more distant cars going up a hill in the distance, and it looks like it's coming out of the swamp, but it's really coming off of a road.
Yeah, there is a road that goes around the other side of it, but what they did to debunk that is they blocked the road off one particular night, and it still occurred. So they looked at that, then they thought it was swamp gas. They thought it was reflections coming off airplanes. So they've had a number of studies to try to figure out what it was, and I guess I was just wondering if you guys had ever heard anything different.
I've never heard of that.
Clearly, we don't get around enough.
No. Well, hey, I'm not too upset about that.
Roadship, boys.
I just want to know how big the frogs are that come out of that swamp. That's what I'd like to know.
Oh, man. Thanks, Steve, for calling. Yeah, I'll have to look into that some more. I mean, I thought that pretty much it had been decided that it was caused by traffic. But
if
they did shut off the road, I'll have to look into that some more. Thanks, Steve. And Jen's, is it, in Sheboygan?
I'm actually calling from Madison, but it is about a wind condition that my friends and I have experienced and taken advantage of a lot in the Sheboygan area. I'm a kiteboarder, and my friend, and we were able to go really reliably to Sheboygan on a forecast of a minimal, if any, west-southwest wind with clear skies and hot temperatures throughout the spring to midsummer, and the forecast will be of maybe 6 miles an hour out of the west southwest. But by noon it will be blowing very close to 20 miles an hour, and blow that until sunset.
What direction?
It'll be out of the southwest.
Southwest. That's weird. I know you've got you got Wind Point in Sheboygan, right? There's a place called Wind Point.
That's actually north of Racine, I believe.
Oh, okay. I had it wrong in my mind.
And the water is always extremely cold, relative to the water elsewhere on the lake, I believe. And we've also experienced this in straight across the lake at Little Point Sable. And that I attributed to more of a thermal because it's a huge sand dune. I mean, a massive, sand dune behind this area where we're at. And I just attributed that hot air going up, sucking water off the lake, creating a thermal wind. Because same scenario over there, no wind forecasted, but it will blow a steady, 20 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a local effect for sure. You've definitely hit it on the head in terms of it being a local effect. And maybe it is a conspiracy between the local heating over the dune area, and then for whatever the oceanographic limnological reason is why that portion of the lake is so cold, that's going to keep the the pressure gradient very strong along the shore near Sheboygan, lower inland, higher out to sea, and that's going to give you pretty good chance for some interesting winds, and they would have a southerly component to them under those circumstances. So that's a very interesting local effect. And your comment brings to mind the fact that when I was in the Puget Sound, there was one of my colleagues at the University of Washington had spent a good deal of his career learning about local wind phenomena in the Puget Sound area. For some reason or another, nobody's really done that here in our state, and yet you're talking about an example of a really interesting local wind phenomena that would be a great thing to study, to try and understand it.
And it's so reliable that they hold the national sailing championships there every...
Unbelievable.
Don't do that, huh?
Every summer, and they get the wind.
Wow, that's really remarkable. Wow. I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah.
Well, nope. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dick in Grafton up next. Hi, Dick.
Hi, I was wondering if with the warm weather we've been having, if your experts think that there'll be enough ice on Lake Winnebago for the sturgeon spearing in February.
I would bet so. Yeah. I mean, that's a fairly shallow lake. So as long as even if we're 5 degrees above normal, we're still going to be below freezing.
Yeah, right. So, and it just, is there any ice at all on Lake Winnebago right now?
I don't think so. I drove up to Green Bay last night for the game, and it was 41 degrees all the way up there.
Yeah, yeah.
There might be a little ice on the shore, but with the winds we've gotten, that's all broken up.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining the lake is pretty much wide open.
Yeah, the winds, though, are good. The winds are what ventilates the lake, so you got to get heat out of the lake by having it be windy. So if you get winds and then it gets cold, which, as Steve points out, it's nearly inevitable that it's going to get cold, here in January and February. I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Should be okay.
For February.
Yeah, right.
Should be okay for February, yes, for sure. Terry from Rice Lake wonders, at what altitude are carbon dioxide readings taken?
The longest record is taken on the top of that
Mount Kea.
Yeah, right, in Hawaii.
Yeah, 10,000 feet.
Is that how high it is? Yeah, I don't know how high it is. It's pretty high. It's above tree line, so yeah. So that's so generally, but now they take it at different spots as well. I mean, they take it at the South Pole. Actually, that's pretty high as well.
Yeah, and one of our colleagues has an instrumented tower in Pox City, is it?
Right,
in Wisconsin,
right.
Goes up in Pox Falls, 400 meters or something, and you take a variety of different measurements of CO2 from forests in the northern part of the state at a large number of elevations. I don't know what the standard is for the one that's reported as the reading, but they seem biased to high altitude,
right?
For some reason,
and carbon dioxide is pretty well mixed too. So you don't think you have to be as accurate height wise as like in temperature, where you want to have it right at the
right
specification.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I understand this one. Maybe you guys do. Bert from South Milwaukee asks: is the Great Garbage Patch in the South Pacific affecting the weather?
I think that must be, there's a big dumping area. There's a lot of garbage that's in the ocean somewhere in the South Pacific.
Because of the circulation of the ocean, right?
Yeah.
Kind of brings it to an area and then it just sits there.
Right, right.
I mean, the only thing I can think of is locally is it would affect evaporation.
Right.
But a lot of that, I mean, it's still a lot of junk. There's still a lot of humidity there. There's still, let's be like a swamp. You still would lose a lot of water off the ocean surface into the atmosphere above. So.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it has a big impact on the global climate. It may have some, as you say, a little bit of an impact on the local climate.
Because I've never heard that story. So there's garbage from all over that gets dumped into the ocean, winds up kind of collecting in a spot.
I think everywhere in the Pacific it finds its way to this spot in the Pacific.
Yeah, it's a gyre in the ocean circulations that just kind of goes around and around. If you get in the middle of that, you got nowhere to go.
Right. And it's a storm-free area, too. There's not a lot of storms that can kick stuff around. Very easily. So it's all ocean circulation that drives it.
Carl in Minocqua, on to you now. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I heard you talking before with that fellow about the Paulding Light up north of Watersmeet, Michigan.
Yeah,
there were a few things I've heard. There was a show on, I think it was on the Discovery Channel, that had gone out there and tried to rule out certain causes for the light, and they were unable to make any kind of a concrete determination. I also read on the internet that the NSA has been out there conducting tests. It passed, I don't know about recently. A friend of mine has an uncle who's a private pilot. Mm. You know, he flies his own plane around, and he said that he checked the aviation maps for that area, and the whole area over that Robbins Pond Road, Paulding Light area is restricted airspace on government-issued aviation maps. Wow. And I haven't seen those maps myself, but my friend says he saw them.
Oh, I like that.
Part of the mystery.
Yeah.
And they also are said to be the only U.S. Forest Service site in the country that has a paranormal emblem on their Forest Service sign. They have a little picture of a Martian or something.
Wonder who carved that.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to guess it's not the National Forest. Yeah, <right.
laughs> Looks like a professionally it's a professionally made wood sign for the Forest Service, and this carving that's in there looks like it was made by the same person that made the sign. It's the same depth, same contours and everything. It looks like they used the same bit to make the carving.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's amazing to me that they couldn't just go in to that area and follow the light right to the spot. Mm. I just don't understand.
What?
Yeah, I've never tried to do that myself. I've been out there just a few times, but I've heard people say that they've walked out. You have to go through kind of a dip or a ravine, and when you come up the other side, the light disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like I've never heard anybody say that they were able to get close to it and still see it. Once you get within a certain range, it just kind of disappears.
Very interesting. Thanks, Carl.
That's okay.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Wow, where do we go from there? I tell you what, we'll go from we'll go to Tina, who had an email wondering about covering her car's windshield, say with an old sheet. Will it prevent frost from forming on it, or will frost form beneath it and cause the sheet to stick to the windshield? Trying to avoid scraping.
Oh, good. Two things. One is I would try it. I think it'd have to get really cold to get the frost underneath the sheet and make it stick. So I would try it. It would probably work on most cases. And even in a case when it sticks, then the frost probably would have been really, really thick and scrape. And the other things you can do is, you know, like if you're parking in the street or on your driveway and there's a tree around, even with you know, no leaves on them. Still, park underneath that and then put your sheet on. That'll actually add some other effects that'll keep the frost from forming.
Is that right?
Yeah. The tree radiates energy, and that's all you need.
That's all you need. And you don't need too much.
Right. Just a little bit of an edge.
Yeah. The other thing you do is just, you know, break the windshield.
Put zigzags across it and point it towards the sun. No, but the tree really works. It's amazing how much it works.
Yeah.
And we have a Prius, and the windshield is really tilted. And no matter what you do, you're going to get a lot of frost on there because it never absorbs any radiation from anything except the sky. But another car we have is a much more vertically oriented one. And if you park it facing a wall or something like that, it's just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the tilt plays a role.
Because you
don't get it on the side windows. You just get it on the windshield, which is tilted, and the one you have to see at them.
Yeah, that's right.
Really and on that happy note, I'll see you guys next year.
Yeah,
right.
Happy New Year. Oh, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, they will be back next year. The first Monday, or the last Monday of the month of January 2012. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.